Welcome to From Idea to Impact, a podcast from Arabella Advisors that focuses on the people at the heart of our work, people who inspire us with their efforts to create positive change and impact in communities across the country and around the world.
Welcome to our podcast. I'm Sharon Church, Southern California Managing Director for Arabella Advisors. I am thrilled to introduce today's guest on the podcast, Cynthia Brunig, President and CEO of Girl Scouts of San Gregorio Council. I have known Cynthia for almost two decades. We are dear friends and former colleagues who worked in deep partnership for community change. We particularly wanted to have this conversation in March during Women's History Month to celebrate and lift up the work that's happening at Girl Scouts and throughout Cynthia's career to empower girls. Cynthia and I spoke via Zoom, and I'm excited to share that conversation with you. Please enjoy my conversation with the leader and friend, Cynthia Brunig.
Welcome and hello, Cynthia.
I'm so
excited for this conversation today. And it really is a conversation. You and I have known each other for more than two decades. We worked in deep partnership and community transformation, which was really started with a shared love and passion for arts and museums. And I had the great privilege of working side by side with you, building and leading Inner City Arts, this gem of a campus in downtown LA, where we fought and really worked to present the arts as a civil right for almost 10,000 LAUSD kids who, but not for Inner City Arts, would not know the joy and the transformative power of visual arts and performing arts. And so I feel like in many ways I'm coming home and just sitting up with a cup of tea and having a conversation with a dear friend. So I want to thank you for your generosity of time and interest to join me today.
Thank you for inviting me, Sharon. It's fun to be able to have this conversation and just enjoy your company.
I want to ask a little bit about your past. So much of our past informs our career and life choices. And I know that your father was a career naval captain and that you lived in many different cities in the U.S. and across the globe. So I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your childhood. Where did you grow up and how, and if at all, those childhood experiences impacted your career choices, including the one that you're at today, where you're leading an organization focused on empowering girls?
A big question, of course.
Yes. Go start big or go home, as they say.
Yeah. Well, I know you met my father when he was a retired naval captain, and he was in the military for 40 years, and we were a classic military family, which means we moved a lot. And Navy families in particular, and I believe this is because they wanted the personnel, the men and women, to train both in the Atlantic and the Pacific fleet, not only moved a lot, but we moved coast to coast a lot. So I don't think I was that unusual. I moved 24 times before I graduated from high school, 24 times. And frankly, I can't remember how many schools, 8 or 10, something like that, a lot of change. And it was pretty exciting. To tell you the truth, my parents were young. They had married when they were 18, and there was a lot of curiosity in the family about wherever we were and what the local cities were like and so forth. But since we were flipping coast to coast, we'd be in San Francisco and Long Beach and Port Hueneme and San Diego and, you know, all the Western ports. And then we'd be back in Virginia and South Carolina. And we were going, we were flipping in that era from California, which had integrated their schools in 1947, into the Jim Crow South. And the contrast was extreme. I mean, California had its problems, don't get me wrong. And you know this, Sharon, and I hope you'll talk a little bit about your incredibly important family and the educational leaders that they were. So anyway, swinging back to going into the South, I mean, for the first time, I'm seeing separate water fountains, separate beaches, separate restrooms, and all that goes with that, all that goes with the old Jim Crow laws, which was extreme. by the time, so I come out of Port Hueneme, which is an all Spanish speaking school in California, go into a farm in South Carolina for a while. Then we're in Virginia. And then we are back in Virginia after being in California. And I wind up at Stratford Junior High when they are the first integrated middle school in the South. And so it was historic. I mean, that's right outside of DC. There was a lot going on. Little Rock and Central High had been just a few years before, and things were pretty extreme. So, of course, Stratford Junior High was part of a group of schools that were integrated all at once. And you and I actually have a mutual friend who was one of the young women that helped integrate those schools. And she and I have compared stories. I never saw her and she never saw me. I mean, there were, I don't know, 5,000 members of the press, probably 1,000, but it seemed like a herd of people. There were a lot of military, and there were these extraordinarily brave children that were doing the hard work of integration. It was astonishing to see that to me. And then of course we're out of there and we're back in California again. At one point in my youth, I would only speak Spanish because that was what I was hearing at school and in my neighborhood. And it was a great shock to me to find out that I wasn't Latina actually.
Wow. Yeah, lots of shared experiences there. And you're right. My father sort of integrated the Pasadena Unified School District. I have a news article on my wall.
Now, wait a minute. I'm going to stop you. He didn't just sort of. If I remember right, he was the first Black superintendent, assistant superintendent in the whole school district.
He was. Pasadena. He was. And the first Black principal and vice principal. And, you know, just to think it was not that long ago. And do you feel comfortable sharing who that mutual friend is or?
Yeah, I definitely. I mean, I don't know if I'm allowed to say that on air, but it was Judy Belk, who's head of the California Wellness Foundation, extraordinary leader. And to hear her story and to understand the backstory of that, you know, just how is a young Black woman, she was selected. I mean, it was the best of the best, not only academically, but of comportment, because who knew what they were going to be facing there in the spotlight. She also shared with me that it was the Jewish community that supported that effort financially, which is a story I had never heard before. It was really a privilege to hear Judy talk about that,
Yeah, I'd never heard that either. Well, I know because, again, I know you. I know that you spent a great deal of your career working with Native American communities. And so I want to know how that came to be and just what you did with that community and where that work led you. And it's certainly timely with the momentum that community is having, certainly on the political landscape these days, too.
Well, that's true. I was doing some work at the Tohono O'odham, who used to be called the Papago, which was kind of a pejorative name, and they thankfully renamed their tribe for the desert people, which they are. It's an enormous reservation outside of Tucson. And at that point, I was working at the University Art Museum, and we were taking programs out to the schools on the reservation, which was really far away. But anyway, of course, I was making friends and this, that, and the other. And one thing led to another. And so a couple of young people and I thought, well, you know what? How about if I, Cynthia, write a National Endowment of Humanities grant? It was called a youth grant at that point because we were really young. And how about the three of us choose, let's say, the five best reservation artists, the elders, and see if we can start an oral history project, you know, really document their lives and so forth. And we did. And then, you know, after all these years, we were supposed to give it back to the school district, but none of us felt comfortable leaving all this incredible, precious documentation. So I carted it around until just a few years ago. And at that point, the Tohono O'odham had established the most beautiful Native Culture, T.O. Nations Cultural Center. T.O. is Tohono O'odham Cultural Center. And the three of us, now we're old people at this point, go and we not only present the artifacts and the oral histories and all the documentation and photographs of these precious elders that were long gone from this world, but they brought in all of the Indian scholars and museum people, and they recorded us and our friendship and our memories from when we were kids. So that lives at the Cultural Center right now, which is really awesome. It was one of the best experiences of my life. And then, of course, you know, I went on to the Arizona Historical Society and got to know the Sacred Kwapdua family. And Emery was a U of A professor, and he's the person that did the first Hopi language dictionary. And I loved Emery. Emery was wonderful. But even more was his mom, Helen Sacred Kwapdua. It was one of the finest women I've ever met. And she wrote Me and Mine, talking about her childhood on the reservation. And would tease me because, you know, I'm in my late 20s. I'm getting a little silver in my hair, and she has no silver in her hair, and she's 11 million years old. So, but you know, they opened doors. I mean, people, I mean, I got to go to a Hopi snake dance, which I don't think is open to outsiders anymore, and just a lot of precious things. And then you may recall that my father-in-law, Chesley Wilson, is a San Carlos Apache elder. And he's of the Whitewater people, and actually a descendant of the Aravaipa Apaches, who were pretty much almost wiped out with the Camp Grant massacre, which is a big American historical tragedy. But he was part of the Indians that took over Alcatraz, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, you know me, I can go on and on. Did a lot of exhibition work with Indians, and even now at Girl Scouts, we have 8 major reservations out in this region in the California desert southwest. And we work very closely with the Tribal Alliance of Sovereign Indian Nations, which is a huge alliance. And they've been very involved with the development of a camp that we bought. And anyway, it's, yeah. As I say, I could go on and on. Stop me now.
Well, and I definitely wanted to ask that question because I know how personal and meaningful it is. And I too have Indian heritage. My grandfather on my mother's side was half Choctaw Indian and born in the Natchez River in the Mississippi there. So lots of ties and connection. I think when you mentioned the work that you're doing with Native Americans and Girl Scouts, it's a nice segue to talk a little bit about Girl Scouts. I think what intrigued me for this conversation was to have you have the opportunity to let us know a little bit about the mission. And we know that Girl Scouts are so much more than the cookies that we often see. Personally, I rose to the level of cadet, and I had the great privilege of leading my daughter's brownie troop in elementary school for 3 years. So lots of ties, deep understanding and respect for what Girl Scouts does. And so I'd like just to hear a little bit more about the mission and what Girl Scout does and what it means to the thousands of girls' lives that you touch every day.
Well, I moved a lot growing up, but one of the through pieces for me was being in Girl Scout troops. I was in several, and wherever we went, I had friends, I had traditions, and shared memories. But in Girl Scouts, you know, it's the most remarkable thing, and you know this as being a troop leader, when the troop leaders can look at a child and their unique potential, what they have the potential to become because of their passions. And you know this happens over and over, but I had troop leaders that looked at me and realized that I loved art. And it wasn't just drawing and painting. I just absorbed it and loved it in my deepest soul. And they're the ones that took me to art museums. It was my first exposure, my first experience. And of course, then set me on a course in which I was a museum executive for decades and got to do all sorts of wonderful things. But that spark has always interested me. And I know it plays out over and over and over again. You also know that I've spent my life working with underserved communities and kids growing up in really difficult circumstances. So this region attracted me. It's San Bernardino and Riverside counties. And while there's pockets of wealth, this is the highest overall poverty pocket in these two counties in California. And so, and very, very few charitable dollars come into this area. The Irvine Foundation did a study several years ago, but it's probably even worse now. Whereas in California, maybe $100 goes, say, if you're an LA child, you know, that our charity, maybe $100 per person would come into your region. Out here, it's about $3, $3 to $7. And we are characterized by the working poor and families having multiple jobs. So I was attracted to the area. I knew the potential of Girl Scouts personally, and I was in for 10 years, as you know, which was the full course of Girl Scouts when I was younger. But then I started getting interested in the research around Girl Scouts. We were a research institute, so we were able to track the impact of the program. And when you and I were at Inner City Arts, that was doing really deep work with homeless children. So I think of it as 2 inches wide, 5 miles deep. It was so transformational. And we were changing the community in one of the worst conditions ever. Suddenly, Girl Scouts is more broad-based. So you've got a broad-based, basically social service agency and transformational agency. And so what are the results? For almost 110 years now, we've been working on empowering girls and women, opening doors for them. Maya Angelou and just all sorts of folks talk about walking through that door that our founder, Juliet Gordon Lowe, opened all those years ago. So if you open that door, what is the possibility for the girls? And so at this point, we know that 80% of our tech leaders were Girl Scouts, that all of our female secretaries of state, 60% of our political leaders, any field that you look at, whether it's education, medicine, you're going to see a predominance of Girl Scouts. So what is happening there in terms of the underpinnings of leadership? And it's the oddest thing, Sharon, because at first, of course, I grew up selling cookies. We all sell cookies. It's just a thing, right? In fact, when yes. I talk to girls, you know, people think I have them in the trunk of my car. You know, it's like, oh my goodness, it's all about cookies. However, here's the thing about the cookies. That actually is the underpinning of an awful lot of what we do. And I'm not talking about the finances and the money that flows in. I'm talking about the lessons that the girls learn and the lessons I learned. I was running my own business. Essentially, I was setting goals, and the girls still do this. I was doing projections. I was learning business ethics. I was learning financial literacy, because these are small businesses that the girls run. And we're learning resiliency. I mean, those girls, I mean, they're out there in front of the stores, not so much right now because of the pandemic, but usually they're out in front of the stores and they're told no over and over and over and over again. So how do you either turn that into a yes, or keep your spirit and your heart strong for that? So the cookies are an interesting phenomenon, but it's not just the cookies, it's a whole entrepreneurial program that are only a portion of the 300 badges that we've got. I'll say one last thing about cookies. And that is, because of my lifelong interest in low socioeconomic communities and the children growing up in them, these cookies are so powerful, because you've got a troop of girls, say at a community center, like I'm thinking of one in particular that we have right now. We go in and we can scholarship them for everything they need, $25 for their membership, but for their uniforms, for all their training information. And then within a year or 18 months, they will have several thousand dollars that as a troop they can use to travel, to have experiences, to go to museums, to go, I mean, it just blows open the world of possibilities for the girls.
Yeah, my brain is thinking about all sorts of things. And it just reminds me in so many ways, you know, Girl Scouts were that first feminist movement. And, you know, credit to Juliet Lowe, who founded it in a time, a place, and a culture that was ultimately created to silence girls. And with Girl Scouts, they have the infrastructure, the support to lean into their voices and their strength. It's really powerful. And especially, you know this, for low income and high poverty girls who don't have other resources and access, Girl Scouts can really be a lifeline. So thank you for sharing that. And it's so much more than cookies, as good as they are. I want to pivot just a little bit. You did mention that you're a 110-year-old organization, which is pretty remarkable in today's world. And I know that you all, Girl Scouts National has hired their first interim African-American CEO. And so I'm wondering, in with the current way that the world is today, how does diversity, equity, inclusion, how does this certain moment of racial reckoning and racial injustice show up in the work that you all are doing at Girl Scouts?
Well, yeah, Judith Batty is now our interim executive director. She's a woman of terrific poise and power. She was a former executive and senior attorney with ExxonMobil, but she was also a Girl Scout, speaking of sparking from a troop leader that sees the potential of a youth. Her Girl Scout leader directed her towards public speaking and towards interacting with laws, and she did great presentations and she got terrific exposure, but she also was a troop leader and of course a top cookie seller, just saying. Judith is leading us through a remarkable period of deep reexamination of our history through a racial justice lens. So starting with the beginning, I mean, Julia Gordon Lowe grew up in Savannah. Her father was an officer in the Confederate Army. I mean, how do you step into that and not in any way neglect to look at your own history? So we've been doing a lot of historical reevaluation. And we know that the second troop in America was an African-American troop out of Massachusetts. That's all great. We can talk about that. However, how long did it take until Juliet's home state in Georgia had not only African-American troops, but then how many decades did it take until Girl Scouts said, we've got to desegregate Girl Scout camps and so forth. So we've got some great highs. We've got a lot of knowledge about our history. Martin Luther King held us up as a force for desegregation. We were featured in Ebony magazine and so forth. And through the years, we've done a lot of work. It hasn't been enough. This is our conclusion. Not only has it not been enough, but it's not been deep enough to affect systems. And that's the work that we're doing now. So we've got 111 councils. Of course, a great deal is being guided through our national office through GSUSA, which Judith heads, but an awful lot of it's happening at the council level. We have 111 councils, which are separate 501c3s. So and most of us have brought in consultants. We're doing the deep work that, the initial work the practices, policies, and the resource flow, that's easy enough to analyze and take care of. We need a little help once we get a little bit further down in the power dynamics of relationships and connections and so forth. And then finally, a lot of help with the implicit, the mental models, the hearts and minds, because this is what we're dedicated to doing, and we've all signed a pledge. And that is making sure that all girls and their families are respected and treated with dignity.
That's powerful. There's an interesting announcement that Girl Scouts is thinking about. This seems like a nice time to share that, sort of who you all will be working in partnership with, especially as you talk about that arc of diversity, equity, inclusion, and exposing girls to some of the amazing thought leaders and powerhouses of our time.
Yeah. Actually, it's going to be launched in early May. We don't have an exact date, but we were approached by Penguin Random House, and that was to develop a program in partnership with the former First Lady of the United States, Michelle Obama. So it's based on her wonderful book, Becoming. And for Girl Scouts, it will be Becoming Me. And that's the program we're doing in partnership. And it's all free to register at Girl Scouts. Registration, by the way, is only $25 a year. but just saying. But anyway, so what comes with this, what they're penciling out right now, which I think is unbelievable, is that it's a unique opportunity for Girl Scouts to embark on their own journeys to become their best selves. So it includes a virtual event, interactive event with Mrs. Obama herself. And then we'll walk girls through, we know, you know, we have six levels, age group levels, and Girl Scouts in each age level has their own three badges, unique badges. And then there's journal activities, there's a facilitator guide, all that stuff is with a free download. It's a really big deal. And we're just proud as can be. I mean, really, Michelle Obama, wow.
Wow is right. And I think you and I spoke about it. I devoured the book myself. And, you know, what's so wonderful is that it's a message for all of us. We're constantly becoming, constantly evolving. And it just strikes me that girls and young women are really going to be the key to building a just world, one that's shifting our globe to ever closer racial, gender, climate, and economic justice. And to think that Girl Scouts is partnering with Mrs. Obama and just the work that you do to really elevate that and bring that to young women and girls across the globe, it's pretty exciting and very needed. I want to ask you a little bit about where you see Girl Scouts evolving over the next 10 years. And one thing comes to mind, I was looking on your website, I see there's a lot of work around civic engagement and advocacy. You did mention that many of our secretaries of states, Hillary Clinton being one of them, are former Girl Scouts. And so just wondering if there are particular areas that you see Girl Scouts really honing in and focusing to sort of help girls grow and to achieve their full human potential across any particular issue area.
Well, we're research driven, of course, and we have to stay current with the needs and the needs and desires of the girls now. And we could never, for example, create a program that is the, you know, my fantasy child of the, that I thought was so wonderful myself when I'm 8 years old. That won't work. You know? I mean, and we've done so much with STEM and cybersecurity. Now we're doing a lot with civics education, which is not as embedded in the schools as it was, doing a lot with advocacy. But one thing we're looking at an awful lot is Gen Z, who the kids that were born after 1995, because they're different. And I think that they're just kind of the tip of the iceberg of Gen Z is the most racially and ethnically diverse of any other generation we've seen in America. And in some areas already we're seeing that the majority are non-white, and it's expected nationwide that we will be by 2026. So they're on track to be the best educated generation that we've seen. And they're also much more familiar and comfortable using gender neutral pronouns. All of that has a lot of impact. So in terms of what is going to happen, I also predict, because they're so much more politically involved, they're pushing back against injustice in a way that gives me such hope. They're raising their voices. I believe we're going to see more of them entering the nonprofit sector. And we've had nonprofits that have been, we've been hurt pretty badly in the pandemic. We've lost over 1 million jobs in the sector. More than, it's almost 7.5% of the workforce has been reduced, but we're still standing, and we are all about community change and making things better. And I believe we're going to see a lot more of Gen Z and the ones behind them going into nonprofit work, which is good for the world.
Thank you for saying that. As a mother to a Gen Zer, my daughter did her first march, you know, after George Floyd's murder. And really, you are correct. Her friend group and the young women that are of her generation are holding us more accountable and really going to be pushing us to get to that racial, social, and equity justice that we all want and are desiring. So that's exciting to see and hear that Girl Scouts is thinking the same way. I wanted to ask you, a little bit about your sort of self-reflection. You know, as we think about life and our careers, what do you tell young women who are just beginning on their journey in any social change career, and any important lessons that you could share with them?
Well, you know, I was watching a video from the great Dolores Huerta recently, and she's just one of my heroes. And she was a Girl Scout. She went clear through some of her biggest. Of course, she was, right. I mean, Gloria Steinem was a girl. Gloria Steinem was a Girl Scout. You know, just you know. Anyway, but I was thinking when I was in Tucson, you know, I got real involved with the farm workers. National Farm Workers, of course, they've changed their name since then. And, you know, I'm not a farmer and I'm not Latina, but there I am because I love Dolores Huerta and all of this. I think it was part of the process. I mean, my heart was in service to others. So I was looking, and I think that's good that you stand up and you show up. So I worked for Young Generation Against Poverty as a CETA program. Only later did I realize I was the only white person there. I don't know if I'm just not observant or what, but it was only in kind of self-reflection. My own family is quite, with my own family back in South Carolina is quite impoverished. And my family, this sounds kind of weird, but my family raised me to believe that I'm nothing special, that without education, I will have the same plight. I am no better than my relatives or anybody else. So education, absolutely. But I tell the Dolores Huerta story because you also need to course correct as you're composing your life, as you get to know yourself better, and you know that you've got an impulse to do something that's bigger than your own life. But what is that? What suits you? And what will illuminate and utilize your own skills. And for me, it was a slow process to realize that my heart was with children that were growing up in great need, and how can I open doors for them? So I think course correct, education, keep learning. I'm still a work in progress, even at this age. I think stay humble. Just because you were born, say the beloved daughter of a wealthy man, which anywhere in the world means that doors will open for you. Mm-hmm. That is only an accident of birth. You did not earn that. I think respect yourself at all ages, and then ultimately to hold on to hope. Mm-hmm. Hold on to hope with your whole heart.
I want to thank you, Cynthia. This has just been such a treat.
You don't know this, Sharon, but when I'm working with our young Girl Scouts, we have a young African American Girl Scout who is earning her Gold Award, the top award in Girl Scouts, and she's been in a lot of marches, and of course she wears her Girl Scout regalia, and we're super proud of her. Anyway, she was doing an interview with me for Twitter, and she said, "Who are some of your heroes?" And I said, "Sharon Church."
Oh. Well, it's mutual. It is so mutual. And we'll have to pick up. I know where you live, so we'll be able to have a cup of tea.
Thank you for listening to From Idea to Impact. To learn more about the guests featured on this podcast and the work we do at Arabella Advisors, please visit our website at www.arabellaadvisors.com.